Run on, everybody, welcome back to Random Short Radio. This is a Rot on God episode coming to you after Season 7, Episode 5 of Game of Thrones, Beyond the Wall. We're going to talk about that episode here, and if you're looking for USC football stuff, we'll be back tomorrow with a full episode of Random Short Radio, number 212, looking at the season predictions of the 2017 season. I'm your host, Michael Castillo, joined along with my co-host, Alicia D'Artola.
Hello, everybody.
And joining us from the What's Brewing Show is our trusty sidekick, Jake Merrifield.
Hey, guys. Nice to hear you guys again. And nice to see you as well. I finally pulled the tape off my webcam.
I know. It's weird. It's weird. Like, you got this, what is it? Is it like Doctor Who behind you?
It's an exploding TARDIS, yes. And a collage of pictures behind the wall.
Yeah, Jake's head is currently blocking the painting of 13 to 9.
That's over there, too. It's right there between the, right there.
Very nice of you. Very nice of you to be able to put that together for us. But what an episode, you guys. What an episode. Jake, you have a confession to make. Make your confession.
Yeah, I actually watched this episode on Thursday, I think, because my neighbor had a leaked version of it. So we watched it early, and for the next 3 or 4 days, I was very upset and pissed off that the showrunners had actually broken the physics of the show, because I was very caught up on the whole travel time of crows and dragons. Since then, I've backed off it a little bit, and I can, if I really push the limits of crows and dragons, I think I can make it work in my mind. So I'm no longer thinking that they broke the show, but they are pushing a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's funny that the one person on the show who is a cop is the one who watched the leak one. Jeez.
Well, in there was a conversation that happened in my house, because I do give Bill Bruin a lot of grief whenever he pirates or does anything of that sort. And my reasoning, and you know, it is a confession, yes, I did watch the leaked version, but I pay for HBO. I've been a subscriber for, you know, 20 years now, so really there's no damage done on my end. Whether I watch it a couple days early or a couple days later, I'm still paying the subscription. So that resolved, at least in my mind. You see how people rationalize these terrible things that they do. I absolve myself of any sin with that line of reasoning. So hopefully you let me off the hook.
Yeah, there you go. I was unfortunately spoiled, which sucks.
And I would also like to add that even though I watched it early, I was very, very careful not to spoil anything for anybody at any time. So I didn't want to do that, right? So no collateral damage in that regard either.
Good guy.
Yeah, I was unfortunately spoiled. Fansided's Game of Thrones site is called Winter is Coming. And on their Facebook page, they had a meme up, which I thought was funny. So I clicked the comments thinking like, oh, this is going to be funny. There's going to be some funny comments responding to the meme. No. Top comment: Danny saves the day with the dragons. They fly in and kill a bunch of whites.
The internet is dark and full of spoilers, Michael. That's what you get for looking at anything Game of Thrones related right now.
I thought it would be safe. I thought it would be safe.
That's a really silly assumption, Michael. I'll tell you that right now.
Yep.
And as soon as Jon told Gendry to go back to Eastwatch, I'm like, God damn it, there it is.
Did he look like a long distance runner to you? He really had a terrible gait to be the fastest guy.
How did they decide that he was the fastest? Because he's like the youngest? I don't get it.
I think because they just wanted to get rid of him and not have him in any mortal danger, I think.
It was kind of messed up, though, that they're like, give us the axe.
Yeah, right. Give me your hammer. Also, Michael and Alicia, I do have it's not really a confession, but just I want to get something clear. I want to clear the air a little bit. I know you guys had some recent reviews, and I've been called out on pronunciations of things, and I would just like to point out that, you know, I am I was born far south of Westeros, and down where I was born in Lotus Point, an island well south of Westeros and Essos. That's how we pronounce it there, you know. And so it's a cultural thing. So don't call me out on my pronunciations, because you know what, you just don't understand. You don't get how I roll.
Yeah, a little bit of inside baseball stuff. We read that review on our full podcast, which will go up on Tuesday. We've already recorded it. We recorded it on Sunday afternoon, but we read the review on there, and we mentioned that you said Westeros, and we defended you. We said, "Hey, you're a book reader. Like, how are you supposed to know? This is the same as Alicia saying hyperbole."
Hey, well, yep. All I'd like to say is my favorite movie is Pirates of the Caribbean, but my favorite song is Caribbean Queen. So, you know, you
yes,
it out.
Yes, it's the exact way to do it. See, it bugs me when people mix the two. Oh, I'm going to see Pirates of the Caribbean, or I'm going to sail down in the Caribbean. No, it's Pirates of the Caribbean and Royal Caribbean.
Yeah, so I'm planting my flag on Westeros.
You say Baratheon, too. Baratheon.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah. And, you know, what's funny is that, I'm sorry, we're off the rails and I apologize already, but if you listen to the, because I've read the books and I've listened to the audiobooks and I've watched the show, right? So I'm full on Game of Thrones guy, but the first couple books for the audiobook of the Game of Thrones series, the narrator, I think it's Roy Latrice, I think is his name, but he pronounces Peter Baelish. In the first couple books, he pronounces it Petyr Baelish. And it's so annoying and disconcerting, right? By the time he gets to Feast for Crows, he's corrected himself and it's Peter Baelish from there on. But, you know, just one of those things. You're right. It's because I'm a book reader and that's how I envision in my mind and I never really got off it.
Well, at least it's not Littlefinger or something like that.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Anyways, let's get into this episode. First reactions on the episode. Alicia, your thoughts.
I have set aside my sort of logical screaming that's going on in my head throughout these episodes, which, like, I'm getting enjoyment on several levels right now in this season, and particularly this episode. One level is I kind of enjoy the process of going, like, why are they doing that? It's so dumb. But also sort of just enjoying the production, because like the production of this episode, these episodes are still really good. Other than the writing today was, I didn't have any complaints. Well, maybe one complaint, but we'll get to that. So like on that level, in terms of dialogue and production, I think it's still hitting the mark. It's just these sort of leaps of logic that we're expected to take. And just like sort of, if I wanted to be really critical, I could just tear apart all of the jetpacking and the like, because the show needs this to happen, this is why it happens kind of logic going on. But once I set those things aside, and the way I'm thinking of it now is like when you go watch like a mindless action movie, you got to just put aside your leaps of logic and just enjoy the action, right? That's kind of how I'm treating it right now. And once I went into that mentality, I enjoyed it a lot more. There can be a whole other conversation about like Game of Thrones was a show that you didn't need to do that in the past, but
now literally everything you're like, I don't think this would actually have happened.
Yeah. But once you put that away, like it all kind of works. It's just like this episode was the exact like coming together of all of those things where it's like, so I'm not complaining about the dialogue. I'm not complaining about any of the production stuff or the visuals, which were awesome. I'm not complaining about the acting or anything like that. It's just the story is so the problem right now. And I can put that aside because if I put aside leaps of logic, I'm still getting enjoyment out of these episodes. So this one, that's sort of where I'm coming from.
Well, it's the story and it's the time that the story is taking place. That's the problem because, yeah.
If they took this and elongated it over a season, it would be different. But having it all in one episode.
Well, what I didn't like about this episode is you can get to the point where you're like, are they going to fight the Night's King? And
I thought that too.
And if Beric is right, like we can totally talk about this later, but if Beric is right that if you kill the Night's King, then the war is over, then are they just going to, like, is the war going to end right now? Because that almost felt like they set that up.
Well, because remember we had that conversation about were they going to end the White Walker storyline this season and then have the final season be all political intrigue? And it being the penultimate episode in past seasons, this is the money-making episode. This is the one where stuff happens. Right. So I was literally sitting there going, no freaking way they're going to kill the Night King today. And then obviously that didn't happen. But
if that would have happened, I would have been upset because then it would have
pissed.
Because
did you guys think there was a real chance they were going to kill the Night King? Because I never had that thought.
No, but I thought that there might have been some sort of battle with the Night King. And if there was a battle with the Night King could have potentially have lost. But my thought was, if that would have happened, you would have had literally seasons since the first season of the whole Winter is Coming, blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden it ends.
In an accidental, like, let's send seven guys out beyond, seven plus the red shirts that can die out beyond the wall. And that's just still happen allow them to kill the night? Like, I seriously thought that's what the way they were going, and I was not happy about it. So in hindsight, at least they didn't do that. At least they didn't do that.
You know, guys, we've been talking for the last few episodes about how are they really going to line up these final two battles, because we have the battle between the humans, and then we have the battle of the humans versus the White Walkers. And I think they're kind of trying to stretch that out a little bit and figure out, they're trying not to telegraph it to us, right? But I think at the end of the day, can we all agree that because this is a Song of Ice and Fire, the final baddie has to be the Night King as opposed to Cersei Lannister or any of the humans, right? I mean, is that where we're at?
That's what I've always been under the assumption that that's what it was. Yeah. Now, actually, what it is, the final scene is just going to be Dragon Ball, and it's going to be Drogon and Viserion going up head-to-head, ice and fire, boom.
Well, the final conflict, you mean, right? I'm sure we'll have some epilogue. I totally get what you're saying. Yeah, but I think that this is all kind of trying to keep from telegraphing it. I don't know how else to say it.
There's different ways it can go now, but it is weird that 7 episodes left, and it feels simultaneously like we're really close to an ending, like it could end in literally one episode, or that we're still so far away. You could go either way, which is definitely a weird feeling. But let's start this recap off right by, let's go a little bit north of the wall, beyond a certain place.
North of the wall.
Yes, with the Magnificent Seven, Jon, Jorah, Tormund, Thoros, Beric, Gendry, the Hound, whoever the hell. And all of a sudden, a bunch of Night Watchmen, which we didn't see earlier,
bunch of red shirts,
appeared.
Yeah. How many guys did you count?
It was weird. So in the very beginning, in the last episode, we see that there's just 7. There's a scene where they're walking and there's just 7. Then all of a sudden, there's a scene where there's like...
I counted 13.
12 or 13, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, where do these dudes come from?
I know. And when I was trying to keep track of the body count, the second time I watched it, I swore they killed off like 14 or 15 guys, but I totally could be wrong about that. I didn't, you know, I wasn't super careful about it. But yeah, right. You're right. There's kind of guys that just kind of materialized.
So it starts north of the wall with a bunch of guy talk as they're all walking. We see Tormund and Jon talking about Mance Rayder, Tormund and the Hound talking about Brienne. And man, the Tormund is all up on Brienne. He's definitely loving that. We see Jon and Jorah discuss Longclaw, and Jorah won't accept Longclaw, which was kind of a noble thing for him. And then Jon and Beric talking about life and death. Beric saying death is the enemy. When you put all these scenes together, did you like it? Did it feel like we kind of gained some background and some foundation for the character development on all those guys, Jake?
Yeah, you know, the reason I liked it is because, you know, we've talked about how they've had all of these reunions, right? And really, we've talked about how the main issues we'll get to later between Arya and Sansa is they've never really sat down and kind of compared notes. You know, because I think if they compared notes, they'd very quickly come to an understanding. This was a really good scene. And when I wrote my notes, it was just Jon and Jorah bond, and then Tormund and Thoros and the Hound and Gendry bond, right? And this is just them kind of catching up and squashing all their beef because they're about to go into the great unknown and battle God knows what. So I thought it was very good that finally some characters actually share some notes and, you know, don't have all this resentment towards each other.
I just really enjoyed the interactions. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, like, most of those conversations were kind of pointless, but the interactions were really fun, so they weren't pointless for that reason. Like, Tormund was awesome. I loved Tormund talking about Brienne, because, like, we've known that's what he wants to do, but, like, him actually saying, like, I want to have babies with her. Can you imagine what they would be like monsters or whatever? Like, just that kind of stuff was just really gratifying and satisfying. And yeah, I think people had been asking about the sword, about Longclaw, and so getting that out of the way, you sort of explain it and all that. Yeah, so I thought those were effective, just sort of like, you know, if you need to have something, at least they tried to show the passage of time,
right,
by cutting back from each of these sort of conversations. Well, and
also, I mean, we're going to talk about Winterfell at the very end because it doesn't pertain to any of the North of the Wall stuff, but when they were in Winterfell, Sansa says that Jon's been gone for a number of weeks. So I thought that was interesting to give us some sort of sense about how much time it's been. But in terms
but it's
of all
just
those...
a, but it, yeah, but that just kind of pisses me off because he's been gone a number of weeks, and then all of a sudden they manage to have crows and dragons fly, you know, in a matter of hours. So don't get me started on that because
teleport.
I just barely talked myself off the edge. So don't take me back there, Michael.
Fair enough. All right. My favorite part of all that stuff was Tormund and the Hound talking and the Hound's thing about Dick. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
that was a good line, yeah.
Really quick, before we get into the battle stuff, favorite character of those seven, Jake?
Probably, you know, I mean, Jon Snow is one of my, you know, he's my fantasy guy, so I'm a little biased here. So if you take away Jon, I've always been drawn to Beric Dondarrion and his whole path and all the deaths and all the nobility and his journey. So I would say him, with a close second being the Hound, because, you know, you got to love the Hound. And then after that, Tormund's probably coming in third, and then Thor's after that.
Alicia, what say you?
Yeah, I like Jon, even though I find him infuriating at times, like every other character that I like. Besides Jon, who's just sort of an obvious, like, I'm rooting the most for him to win, I most enjoy when the Hound is in a scene.
Yeah.
Like, I can't remember the last scene with the Hound that I didn't enjoy, so.
Never. Never.
Yeah.
The Hound is awesome. The Hound is easily my favorite character. For a while, it was Davos, and Davos still has, you know, episodes like last week where he's super good, but to me, the Hound made this episode, because we see the Hound, like, all parts of him. We see the great warrior. We see the Hound where he's just fed up with life. We see the Hound where he's timid and he's afraid, and we're going to get to that in a couple of minutes. We also see the Hound where he's, like, you know, just crabby, and he just, he was everything, but funny at the same time, witty. We see everything. We see everything of the Hound, and I absolutely, absolutely adore that. Let's go into the next encounters that we see those guys north of the wall. All of a sudden, they come up on some bears. Some, like, undead white bears, polar bears, whatever you want to call it. And Thoros gets, first of all, a red shirt dies.
Yeah.
At first, I'm like, who the hell was that? Like, was that someone we needed to know? Like, why didn't they show his face? Well, they didn't show his face because it was nobody of importance. And then Thoros gets mauled by the bear. The Hound completely, you know, freezes up, doesn't know what the hell to do. Jorah ends up killing it. And moments after that, they sneak up on a group of whites. Jon kills the White Walker. All the whites around it die. And the white, like, goes on to this distress call where he just starts screaming, 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 screaming. And that's how they call the Army of the Dead.
Question before we go on with this. How many White Walkers are there actually, do you think? Do we have any idea?
I feel like it's, like, maximum a dozen.
Now, see, you say there's maximum a dozen, and I went back before, you know, in the interim since the last time we talked, and there was the scene where they actually showed a White Walker being born via, you know, being turned from one of Craster's babies into one of the White Walkers. And if you think about how many babies Craster got rid of, he got rid of, like, 85, 90, I want to say it was, like, close to 100 babies. Did all of them become White Walkers? Could we possibly have a stable of that many of these bad boys out there, right? I mean, but in the episode, we're only seeing four or five at a time right now. So I'm curious to see if there's, like, a bigger army.
I wish they talked more about the difference between a white and a White Walker.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the white is definitely, the undead, you know, somebody dead who's been brought to life, kind of like, you know,
Jon and Beric are fire whites.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly, right. But they haven't lost their ability to make their own decisions. But you see that, you know, you saw all the undead waiting around the pond where
Those
are the whites. You know, those guys didn't seem like they had too much going on brain-wise. Although that one skeleton guy was able to figure out with the, you know, the rock and whatnot.
Right.
He's at least smarter than the Hound. But yeah, I'm curious to see how many of these White Walkers actually turn up at some point.
Yeah, I mean, they've only ever really shown us, like, five or six at a time, but I'm with Jake. Like, I think there's got to be a lot more of them, because otherwise, I know killing a White Walker is a big deal, but we've now seen several White Walkers killed, and, like, it doesn't seem to be, like, if there were only, like, a dozen of them or less, then why would they have the singular White Walker with the little band of whites that he was sort of bringing along? Like, I just feel like they wouldn't split up like that into such small groups if there weren't a number
of
them.
Well, yeah. What was this little troop with the one White Walker that Jon kills? What was he doing? Like, what was he doing on his own?
At first, I thought. Well, yeah, you could have a scout party, or I thought like this is like a scout party in the sense that he's going out and then collecting his whites and then bringing them back to the main force, right? That's what I thought at first.
That could be.
But if the main force was that close, then I just don't know.
Well, here's the one thing. I was listening to the Bald Move Instant Reaction podcast right before we started recording this, and they were talking about how the White Walker stumbles upon that little fire. Was that fire a trap that the Magnificent Seven set to kind of get the White Walkers to go there? Or,
that's what I thought.
I took that as a ruse, yeah.
Or was that Benjen's fire, and was that the prelude to Benjen being there later on in the episode?
I think the way they set that up, it just seemed like, well, we need to get going, and then there's the fire, and then like it just felt like a trap, like a very not effective trap. I don't know.
Right.
I think it was very much a ruse or a trap, because, you know, that's why they were able to spring into action and ambush him, right? It was an ambush. That's what it was.
Yeah, and we see them being able to take the white hostage before he yells, and the distress call I thought made sense, because we know they can't talk. So I was thinking, well, how is he going to like signal? And that little scream thing completely made sense. I thought that was a great little aspect there. But let's talk about Jon sending Gendry back to Eastwatch. What makes Gendry the guy to send? Is it, he said it was because he was the fastest. A, how do we know Gendry's the fastest? And B, doesn't this kind of suck for Gendry that he just makes this triumphant return to the episode, and then all of a sudden he becomes a mule?
Well, he's the youngest. I think he's the youngest, so that could be sort of what they're thinking by the fastest. Also, I think it was just convenient that they got him out of the way, because if he survived that fight, it would, I don't know, you'd be sort of stretching the imagination. I mean, they're already stretching a lot of imagination here, but like,
right,
just getting him out of the way.
He's the only unproven one.
Yeah. Like, you buy that the Hound and Tormund and Jorah could hold their own there. Like, Gendry could like swing his sword around, but we know he's not at their level, so might as well get him out of the fight.
But him being useless, doesn't that also make him being more susceptible to being killed? Or more susceptible to not knowing his way back to Eastwatch?
Well, that's what was something
I
was
Tormund
thinking
would
as
make
was
the
running.
Most sense.
Yeah, well, like,
well, yeah, I don't know. He's like, he's the wildling. They're not going to send a wildling back. They're going to send Gendry because, number one, he's the kid. Number two, he's the least. He's the named character that they all know the least, right? So they can't rely on him as much as you could rely on the Hound or on Tormund or any of those guys. They're all, you know, kind of like experienced, I should say. So, I mean, to me, I wasn't that caught up on why they'd send Gendry, other than the fact that they say that he's so fast, and then when you watch him run, he doesn't exactly look like somebody from Ghana in the Olympics or anything. You know, he did not have a very effective stride.
All right, well, from an in-story perspective also, if you're Jon, if you're Jon and you think, oh, crap, we're effed, I think it makes sense that he goes to Gendry as being the sort of youngest, the one that's...
But couldn't you also make the case that the Hound would have been the best person to send? Regardless of the speed, if you took out speed from it...
No, you want the Hound staying to fight with you.
The Hound's
also carrying the dude, the white, like...
Right, but we just saw the Hound, how he froze up. That he was like, he's obviously afraid of the undead. He's
no,
afraid
he
of
was,
fire.
The
he's
bear was on
things.
Fire. That was the problem. Like, that's the only reason the Hound froze up. If
but
the bear
still,
wasn't on
like,
fire, I don't think that would have been a problem.
But you know, the Hound is going to be fighting next to Beric Dondarrion, who has a flaming sword.
Yeah, but I don't think Jon's thinking. I think Jon's just seeing young kid get you out of here. Like, that's right. The noble Jon kind
that,
of thing.
To be honest with you, Michael, I did not even. Like, I didn't think about that. That didn't catch me at all. But I understand what you're saying.
Let's move on and talk about the next part of this battle. They turn the corner there at that little ridge, and all of a sudden they're on a lake. This is where the running scene we saw in the preview of them running, we didn't know what they were running from. Well, they were running from the whites, only to get surrounded by the rest of the whites. And they're on this like lake where the ice kind of breaks around to where I think they were on a little island. They were on a little island that had the lake break around it. So they were just completely surrounded, and it's the, oh my God, we're screwed moment. But since John has already sent Gendry to Eastwatch to call for Danny to give some backup here, you had to know they were going to get out of it, right?
No, absolutely. We knew, even if we thought that some of the characters that were involved in that journey were probably not going to make it back, we also knew that at the very least some of them were going to make it back, right? Because if they all die, then they're not all going to die because the show doesn't move on from there. But it was, how are they going to do it? And when I was watching it, I didn't believe that you could get a response, emergency response from the Dragon Patrol in such a short period of time. But apparently I was proven wrong.
Well, not to push you further to the cliff, Jake, but thinking about it even more. So we have this group, who travel some amount of time because they spend half the episode going back and forth between these conversations and they're traveling. Yeah. And then they send Gendry back. So Gendry has to run the length that they've just traveled, which we're thinking, what, they've traveled several
half
hours
a day's
at
worth,
least?
A day's yeah. worth, yeah.
So I have this
Gendry
feeling,
has to run.
Not to cut you off, but I have this feeling that, like, there was, they have talked about a lot about how the story is rooted in both mythology and ancient history. Didn't it feel like that was kind of the story, the mythology of Marathon? Because in Marathon, the idea of was the guy, and I can't remember the guy. The guy runs was to or from Marathon to tell everybody that there was trouble.
Yeah, and didn't there he was drop a battle dead right afterwards?
Yeah, wasn't that kind of, it kind of felt like the same thing?
A little
with
bit.
With Gendry.
A little bit.
Yeah. But that's one leg of the journey. Like that leg of the journey was going to take he's running, but it's still going to take him several hours.
And that felt like a half day. He ran for a half day.
Okay, so
and
he
even
runs
if that's
for a
the
half
case,
day.
Yeah, even if that's the case, the big sticker isn't the fact that Gendry could run from wherever they were back to Eastwatch. That I can wrap my brain around. But what I can't wrap my brain around is we know the only measurements we know on the show is that the wall is 100 leagues long, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 miles long. And then if you look at any of the maps and compare how long the wall is to how far it is to Dragonstone, I'm giving a very conservative estimate. Conservative, because I could make the case it's like 1,500 miles, but it's like 1,200 miles from Eastwatch to Dragonstone, and that's when, like I said, my mind was doing the mental gymnastics. I'm guessing that the dragons fly at supersonic speed or something, and that the crow was flying at top capacity, or I'm sorry, the raven or whatever, but it's still, it's hard to kind of justify.
Well, it's just these things that are weighing down the show now, because like I said, I still enjoyed this episode. But I'm also, like, totally on board with having this conversation and spending several minutes talking to you guys about how ridiculous this time, like, jetpacking is. Like, this is more ridiculous than the stuff from the previous episodes where, like, Jon and Tyrion and everybody are going back and forth between these places in the span of, like, 5 minutes on the episode. Like, there actually was a time constraint here that we have to believe that these guys were able to survive surrounded by an army of whites for days, apparently, like,
and I in the episode I only counted one night. When they wake up, they go to sleep, and it goes
and
back to
dead.
Danny or whatever, and then they wake up and it's kind of daytime again. So I only really counted one day from the point to when they cut Gendry loose. But I could be talked into a couple days, I guess. I would have to be talked into a couple days to believe the time frame.
Yeah,
here's how I see it. This happens in the middle of the day. So it was, we'll say, 4 hours for Gendry to run back to Eastwatch. The Raven flies as soon as they get there in late afternoon, flies all night, gets to Dragonstone in the morning. They fly up, and it takes a few hours to go from Dragonstone to where the battle was. Because I see the dragons as like flying like a plane. So it should only take...
It's going to have to.
Like four, we'll say like 4 hours. Still, that's like 300 miles an hour, which is incredibly fast. But just think about how large it is.
This still stretches the imagination. It's not like a deal breaker for me, but the fact that we can have this conversation is a problem for the show.
I'd hate to like go full geek mode on us now, but when I was a boy, I read these books called The Dragon Riders of Pern, and it was all about dragons and riders of dragons and whatnot. And the way that they got around these distances in that book series was they had the dragons kind of go into like a warp speed, you know, kind of like a wormhole type of thing. And after I watched this episode, the first thing I was thinking of is they're going to have to introduce some new kind of device to get these dragons from one place to the other. But like I said, if you really stretch really far out, I guess you can justify it because it is still ambiguous, just like it was ambiguous how they got the army from Dragonstone over to, you know, to Casterly Rock, and the Euron got from one side of the continent to the other side of the continent. It's all ambiguous enough that I guess if you like squint, you know, really kind of make your eyes blurry, you can believe it. But it's really pushing it.
But even if you make the argument that the Raven took a day to get there and the dragons took a day, you know, 2 days, 2.5 days, when you add in Gendry running back to the wall, I think that makes sense with what they showed. I think you can make the argument that 2.5 days would have sufficed.
Like I said, I'm no longer on the edge, but I'm pretty close.
I just don't like the idea of them like spending 2.5 days sitting there with an army.
What bothers me more than anything is that the dragons swoop in at just the freaking perfect time.
That's what
bothered me.
That's what happens. I mean, come on. What
bothered me is imagining how horrible it must have been with them sitting all in that enclosed space while they're burning a body. Like,
mm-hmm.
that sounds really unpleasant. Like, burning flesh is supposed to be like a really, really, really not fun thing to be around. So,
right. Let's talk about how Thoros eventually dies from his wound suffered at the hand of the bear. And they have to burn the body because they don't want him to turn into a white, obviously. And Beric does the honors and says the magic words.
For the night is dark and full of terrors.
Didn't we all call Thoros being the one to...
In the books, Thoros is such a bigger character than he is in the show.
Call Thoros dying? Because I thought we called Beric dying.
I did.
I think I called
Oh, I definitely Beric, called so Thoros.
I'll give you guys credit because I think I said Beric. Because that's how I remember it.
Either way, again, and I apologize for like nitpicking here, but I think this episode also really highlights one of the other problems this season has is that characters clearly have plot armor, and that was never had that feeling in past seasons, but now, like, I never feared for Jon's life. I never feared for like.
But Thoros.
I thought Tormund might die, but.
But I feel like Thoros dying took the plot armor off of Beric and off of Jon.
Yeah, you know, and this
except
is a good time
that
to talk
obviously
about
not.
Yeah, but this is a good time to talk about that. And this is kind of what my thought on this was, because if you look at the net take on this body count on this episode, you lose Thoros, you lose Benjen, and you lose the dragon, right? But even though those are three big major losses, three named characters, so to speak, right? You and the dragon, Viserion, or whatever. I think that. Because you're Alicia, everybody I talked to about this episode, pretty much to a person, said mention the plot armor thing. But I think that the problem isn't that they didn't kill Jon and they didn't kill Tormund. The problem is that they made such a big point to put him in so much jeopardy. Right? If they had Jon fall through the water, they had Tormund almost gone, and then he's miraculously rescued. I think if they wouldn't have laid it on so thick, we wouldn't have that feeling, because they did actually kill off three things. Or they killed off three dang people, or, you know, two people and a dragon. But they laid it on so thick that it really was the problem.
Well, yeah. That was supposed to, like, for instance, like Tormund being saved by the Hound, I thought was a great moment because it's the Hound who saves him, right? Cool. Jon being like Jon, it's literally Jaime 2.0. Like, oh, dude falls into the water. Ambiguously dead? No, he's miraculously returned. And
he didn't have anyone pulling him up this time.
Yeah.
You know, what, Alicia? I had the exact opposite reaction in that, you know, the Jon thing, yeah, he came out of the water and I was like, yeah, okay, that's convenient or whatever. But I really was more, I was rolling my eyes more at the Tormund one because he was, you know, not only did he get buried by a couple bodies, but he had two guys pulling him from the bottom.
Yeah.
And, you know, and gee whiz, that other guy that fell into, you know, the nameless, you know, red shirt that falls off the cliff right before Danny rescues him, that, you know,
instant
John kind of reaches out to grab, instant death for him.
Yeah.
But Tormund somehow, you know, manages to sit there underneath the pile for, you know, half a minute. So
right.
That's the one I was rolling my eyes at.
Well, more. Especially because that red shirt got completely torn apart, like immediately just torn
that's
apart.
What I'm
his
saying,
innards
yeah.
are just being thrown about.
It was like 28 days later, you know, right. massacre, you know.
Right, but we saw this before, wasn't it Tormund who got in the fight with that that Karstark guy in the Battle of the Bastards, where we thought that Tormund was going to die, and then right. he ended up living.
Well, and you bring it up too, dude. And I know we haven't gotten to the point where Danny rescues him, but we might as well. Did you guys, when this episode was playing out, and we knew that Danny was going to swoop in after, you know, they send word with the Raven? Did anybody have the feeling that this is exactly where we were with Jon and Tormund? One season ago in the penultimate episode, because that's I was like, this is Battle of the Bastards 2.0.
But it's Danny instead of the Knights of the Vale.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it really was the same beat that they're hitting. So that was
except they called for help themselves this time.
What's that? Yeah, they called for help themselves. Yeah.
Right. Though one thing I do want to get into so the dragons come down and start just flaming everything and saving the day, and then we see the Night's King, and he gets his spear, and he takes down Viserion, which I thought was beautifully done. I love the way the blood or the innards were like coming down. I thought that was really
well
done.
And he like is on fire, like
yeah. I like the way it went into the lake too.
Oh, some great CGI work in this episode. Like some mm-hmm. really spectacular visuals that were very clearly all CGI. Like, yeah, that
right.
was that was awesome.
You mean they don't actually have dragons?
No, they don't actually have dragons. But
no, and the reason I liked it too is you mentioned because he was once the spear penetrates him, he kind of bursts in the flame almost, and that's once again going back to these mythical creatures and how really that fire is a mythical part of them too. You know, they're just they really are just creatures that are made of fire, and once that fire is extinguished, you hits the water and goes out, everything kind of goes
right.
out with them.
And
awesome.
so like I had mentioned plot armor before, it's like almost like reverse plot armor with that one, because I mean, going back to Drogon before, like I didn't really think that they were going to kill Drogon. I was really worried about it during that battle earlier in the season. But I there was part of me that was always like, they're not going to kill Drogon. They can kill one of the other two. Those are the red shirts. Those are expendable. So as soon as all three dragons go off to save it, like it was pretty clear to me that they can't have these nuclear weapons be totally like effective and just be and exist. So they're going to have to start killing them
right.
off. So you just sort of knew that they were going to kill them off. The problem being is like, well, so then why like this could all have just ended if Danny had just noticed the Night King and then
attacked him
boom,
first.
Dracarys.
Yeah, absolutely,
done.
Right?
I mean,
yeah, the entire war is over.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
See, so one of the things that bothered me was not only that she swoops in at the right time, but also this idea that yeah, like you said, that they're susceptible to fire. Well, the dragons have fire, so what's the big deal? They're just going to flame them all and be done with it. But I really liked, and to me what saved the episode, was that Viserion dies and then later on gets resurrected by the Night's King. And I love that because it kept the balance. It allowed the White Walkers to still have the upper hand. Because I don't like this idea that they're just going to be this really easy army that's just super easy for Danny, because we saw how easy that battle was 2 weeks ago.
Well, and so far, yeah, they're the only ones that put Danny in any jeopardy, because we saw
right.
the big ruse with the scorpion. And, oh, yeah, this is going to kill a dragon. Oh, it's going to go through their skull. And then, oh, no, okay, it winged him a little bit, but
right.
that's about it.
But she was able to just torch the Lannister armies, like, super easily.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, and once again, we get back to what is the main battle going to be? Is it going to be the humans on humans, or is it going to be the humans versus the whites and the White Walkers? And I think we know what that is.
Well, this
right.
ice dragon is now the great equalizer and adds a lot of stakes to, I mean, it already felt like they were trying to tell us, like, oh, yeah, this is an impossible battle. We need all people to be get together. Now I feel like the Army of the Dead really has, like, they're on even footing, because now we're going to see dragon on dragon battle. And
right. What does that dragon breathe, by the way?
See, I was wondering this. I think it has to be ice. It has to be like frozen nitrogen that comes out.
I think it has to as well. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like they, you know, it like freezes everybody and they fall apart into little shards. I think that's what's coming.
It's like Sub-Zero from like Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Get over here.
Oh, no, here's the crazy thing. It freezes out the I mean, it sends out that stuff. Does it freeze the people and immediately turn them into walkers? Oh. Ooh.
There's an idea. I doubt it, but there's an idea.
That would be nuts. But to sum up this battle, John lives, Tormund lives, just like we talked about. The Hound lives, Beric somehow lives, and they all live with the exception of Thoros. And we see that Gendry gets the ejector seat early on. But really quick, before we get to the fallout, when Jon was going into that thing, before he gets saved by Benjen, or Cold Hands, whatever you want to call him, did you think this was the end of the road for him? Or as soon as he went down, did you totally think that he had plot armor and it didn't matter?
I think there
was a solid minute or two that I thought, okay, this is it. And I would have been okay if he was dead.
No, it's so transparent. It's so transparent because of the way that they try to kill somebody. Like, for instance, Tormund, the elongation of that whole thing, it kind of telegraphed, like, okay, well, we need to have him almost dead, but then get him, like, elongate it so that we give somebody an opportunity to come in and save the day. Jon falling into the water and not actually meeting his death in a very visual way telegraphed the whole thing. That's a cheap way to just do, like, oh, maybe he is dead. No, he's not dead. If you have to say maybe he is dead, he's not dead.
What I my response was is, yeah, I didn't think he was dead for even one little microsecond. But what I did, what was going through my mind is the Night's King going to capture him? And are we going to have some scene of Jon being a prisoner? What I was wondering is how is that going to work? And so, my brother-in-law was watching it with me, and he said, oh, yeah, I totally knew Benjen was coming. You know, he's from New York, so he has the accent and whatnot. But he's like, yeah, I saw that coming a mile away. I didn't, because I was like, well, are they going to make him a prisoner or whatever? But no, I never thought that Jon was going to buy it. And what did, you know, there was a couple, you know, I haven't been eye-rolling a lot this season, but I did eye-roll when they show the scene of Dany on the Eastwatch balcony, and she's looking and, like, wondering.
My only
thought was, what the hell would make her think that he was still alive? You know, why would she think he was still alive? Because if she thought he was still alive, maybe she'd try to go plunge back there and go get him or something. Maybe, but
yeah,
why
didn't
she
take
Drogon
back and tried to see or something?
Well,
yeah. She didn't want to lose Drogon too. But like,
well, yeah, you can't put the dragons in danger now. But I did, like, the only thought I had for how is Jon going to get out of this, besides the whole is he going to get captured thing, was that maybe what's the other the one that's named after Rhaegar. Rhaegon. Yeah, that Rhaegon would come over and save Jon, and then that's how we would get the second Dragon Rider.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, like that's how I thought that he was going to get out of there, is that the other dragon was going to come through and he was going to ride him, and then it was like oh, Dragon Rider.
Talk about a deserter, though. Can we talk about Rhaegon? Like, where the hell did he go?
He was there. I think he left with Dany. You said you didn't see him. Yeah. I thought I saw him.
It's cheap, though. Cheap. Super cheap.
He's dodging spears.
I know, but the thing that bugged me about Dany, not only was the idea that she was just waiting for him.
How the hell would she think he's alive? Go ahead.
And then they're looking out over the wall, and there he is, and she sees a horse. She doesn't know what the hell that horse means, and as soon as she sees that horse, she knows it's him. Like, give me a freaking break. Gag me.
Well,
You're
I was trying
Mike,
to
Michael, your heart is full of is made of cold stone.
So I was wondering, was it Jon that she was waiting for, or was she hoping that maybe that Viserion would like pick himself up and come fly back? Like, that whole scene was weird.
Yeah, no, I didn't ever think she was longing for the dragon. I mean, that's that they were telling us she was longing for Jon, but.
That
scene probably bothered me more than any scene this episode, and with the exception of the cave, probably any episode this season.
I didn't like that we saw Dany. Like, I liked what we saw from Dany in later scenes where she's, like, mourning, where she's clearly mourning Viserion, I didn't like that we see her and she's not mourning the dragon.
Well,
like, not visibly mourning.
Right. Let's get into that. So after this, we see them all meet up at Eastwatch, and then they load up a ship, a Targaryen ship at Eastwatch, to go to King's Landing. And on this ship, we see Dany right in front of Jon, waiting for him to wake up. He wakes up, and she visually sees that, like, he wasn't dying. He wasn't lying about being stabbed in the heart. She can see his scars and all that kind of stuff. And he bends the knee. She ends up telling him that, you know, basically, I was more worried about you than my dragon, without exactly saying it, even though at least that's how I took
Did
it. You're looking at
that?
Me funny. You're looking at me.
No, I actually really liked the opening beat of that scene, because, you know, Dany is a queen. So her whole thing is about containing her emotions. Right. We see her do that. Like, you know, she keeps herself contained. So I really like that, like, that the way they played that, where he says, I'm sorry. And she's like, screwed up face, like just trying not to like sob, and she stops herself from sobbing. But I liked that we saw that kind of, like, that's the closest thing to anguish we saw in the minute since, like, we didn't see anguish on her face when the dragon first gets pierced and clearly dies. Like, we didn't see anguish from her, so I liked that they showed that kind of anguish. I felt like it was her really having a moment of mourning for Viserion, and like, I didn't read it as like, I cared more about you than the dragon. Like, I felt like that was clear. Like, she was really torn up about
this. I took it as kind of guilt. I think if he would have died, she would have been guilty. She would have felt guilty for the whole plan, I think. And B, I think it would have proven, because we had seen earlier that they had talked about how, oh, these guys are willing to die for me, blah, blah, blah. And, oh, this is how hard to get I am, that I let these dudes be willing to die for me and I still won't give in, blah, 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 talking about Jorah and Daario. And yet she sees that Jon, A, has actually died before, B, was willing to die for everybody there, and I think she would have, A, felt guilty about that, B, been really touched. And I think she would have been really touched and it would have proven to her that Jon was somebody that was worth her time.
Right, that's exactly what they're going for, but I think it's completely separate from, like, those are completely separate emotions from her feelings for Jon, as far as his nobility and sort of coming to an understanding of who he is and who we know he is, and then separating it from, like, she's really torn up about her dragons. Like, that's a, like, they're not.
But I take it as she can only have three things in her life at any given time. Let me explain. Like she had Khal Drogo. To get rid of Khal Drogo, she got the three dragons. She loses Viserion, but she gets Jon added to her life. So now she has Jon and two dragons. It's still three.
I mean, I agree about her feelings for Jon in that, like, in that moment and all that. But I don't think it had anything to do with her feelings about losing Viserion. Like, I don't think he's a replacement, right. And I don't think he's. I don't think
Not
she
that he's
cared
a replacement.
More about him or anything like that.
Yeah, I don't think it's a replacement. It's more so of, like, I lost this, but I gained you. And, like, it just felt like a character development thing for me. Like, she realized that she can lose and win at the same time.
Yeah, and from what you're saying, Michael, I don't know if I felt that she felt guilty about, you know, possibly leaving Jon out there. I thought that the overpowering thing for her was, obviously, she felt grief for her for losing her dragon, and this whole theory of three thing, I don't know about that, but the overriding thing is, and they are laying it on very, very thick, is that Dany's loins are now burning. They're like on fire for Jon Snow, and they are trying to get that established, whether it's an aunt and a nephew, or whether it's just two you know, like, late teenagers falling in love.
Can we talk about the worst line of this episode? Can we talk about the worst line of this episode?
Oh, okay. Yeah, let's do it, Michael.
As soon as this happened, I was so close to, like, just finding a freaking Valyrian sword and just gutting myself. When he calls her Dany, and then she's like, oh, ooh, nobody calls me Dany. And he's like, fine, Lord Dany. Oh, God, freaking kill me.
What
no,
he said,
I, like,
He says, fine, I'll call you my queen. And then that's how he gets to tell her that he's going to bend the knee, which I think was very clearly like, how are we going to get her to him to tell her that he's going to bend the knee? Let's have him call her my queen. But how do we get him to go to that? I don't know. Let's have him, like, it was just really bad writing. Really, really bad
writing.
Have
we ever heard her be called Danny in the show?
No.
Michael, that's really what I was wondering. Like, when I was thinking back when they said it, it sounded odd to me as well. And I didn't have quite the, oh my God, this is terrible reaction. But what I did say is, even in the books, does anybody call her Danny at all other than, like, her brother at the very beginning? And I mean, I know that's what she said.
That's what we call her. That's what fans call her.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is that the reason why the fans call her that is in the books, in the narrative of the books, they always refer to her as Danny, but nobody calls her Danny, right? The narrator calls her Danny, but nobody else does. So I thought it was kind of like it was almost like a cheat, a cheat to intimacy.
So
you see what I'm saying?
So actually, instead of Sam writing the books, it's going to be John who writes the books.
Maybe.
I just thought it was like out of nowhere. Like, why on earth would he think that would be okay?
Right.
Like, even if they've just had this moment, like you just suddenly all like make up a name. This seems very, very odd.
Yeah, I agree with Allie.
And I mean, like, yeah, if you just all of a sudden, like, we had a moment and you just all of a sudden go like, just call me like Ollie or whatever, it'd be like. My dad calls me Ollie. No one in my life has ever called me Ollie other than that. Like,
you'd feel weird, right?
It would be very, very odd that you would just come, like, that's the nickname you would come up with.
Right. Yeah. You're like someone walking up to me, like a random person. Hey, how's your day, Mick? Like, hold on. Wait, what?
How do you know? Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't work. But anyways, let's move over and stop talking about these guys and go to the other part of the East and the other part of this thing, which we have to go back in time a little bit. But let's go back to where Danny's from.
Dragonstone.
Tyrion Lannister. And Danny's there too.
Yeah, let's talk about Tyrion and Danny. Obviously, this is going back in time. This is pre-battle, but I thought it was worth our while to talk about this. Tyrion and Danny have this little bit of a verbal spar where Tyrion is like, hey, you need to be level-headed. All the things you want to accomplish in your life, they may take multiple lifetimes to get there. And he's trying to tell her the opposite of anything Olenna told her about the dragons be a dragon. And she kind of doubts him. Like, at one point, she's like, if I didn't know better, I'd think you were on the side of your siblings. And then he's talking about, like, basically you need to have a successor in mind just in case the worst happens. She completely hates this. We'll discuss my secession after I wear my crown. Alicia, who's right?
I think Tyrion is right here. I think that Dany is being short-sighted. And I think she's having an emotional reaction because my thought is that we're supposed to get from this that Dany shuts him down because she might still be a little bit sensitive to the whole, like, can't have kids thing, which I had totally forgotten about, like, 100% completely forgotten about, that was a thing.
Wait, how do we know that she can't have kids? Is it because when Dyad was doing the stuff, it completely screwed with it?
Yeah.
With her, and then...
Some Orphan Black reference in
here. Her clone thing's all messed up, yeah.
I know, right? Well, I was trying to remember if there was any lines or anything like that about, like, when she had the first, the baby that was all messed up, or the whole burning in fire thing, or any of those things like that. I don't know if anyone explicitly,
it's all the,
like,
first
told
season
her
fallout,
that she,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was sort of a thing. So I think Tyrion is on point. Like, yeah, Danny, you kind of do need to have somebody who's going to lead your armies in case something happens to you. Like, you do need to have a thought about what's going to happen to you when you are no longer with us, because you are riding a dragon and anything bad can happen while you're doing that. And I think she was being hostile towards him because she, you know, just because she's hostile, but also the idea that, like, she might be a little bit sensitive to that whole thing.
Yeah, and I thought this was just, you know, it was just more, and really, once again, laying it on thick with the foreshadowing, because they had to get it out there that she, you know, that she or one of the dragons could die at any moment. But more so, I was then her being sensitive about the kid, about not being able to have a kid, it just struck me that, number one, they had the foreshadow. That was the number one thing. But then the number two part was she seems to still be a little bit annoyed with Tyrion over how the war has gone up to this point. And she's not quite over it to where she respects Tyrion. She wants his advice. But this is like one of those things where she like automatically kind of lashes out. Yeah, but you told me to do this and it didn't work out. You know, kind of one of those things. And we'll see if she's finally getting over that, especially now that Tyrion kind of ended up being semi-right in this case, even though she did go rescue Jon.
Well, after the battle and after Jon bends the knee and all that kind of stuff, how much do you think it changes? Do you think that at the end of this episode, she sees that Tyrion is right? Or is that some sort of line of thinking she's going to still have to come around on?
I think in the back of her mind, she knows Tyrion's right, but at the same time, she's kind of gone into, I have dragons and I need to do what needs to be done. And
right.
But I think that what Tyrion's told her is kind of making her kind of understand like how she killed off the Tarleys and all that stuff. She just hasn't quite resolved it yet, but I think she's going that direction.
Well, do you think we're completely set up to the fact that Jon is a successor, or if they ever learn that Jon has more of a right to the throne than Dany does, that Dany is a successor to him?
I was going to ask, I was curious, because I did notice that for the first time in forever, there's discussion about Dany not being able to have kids. And then you also have a little line from one of the Guy Talk talks of Jorah telling Jon to pass that sword down to his children. And I don't think it was by accident that they include that line in this episode and this talk about how Dany can't have kids. And then later on, again, they reaffirm Dany telling him essentially like very, very wink, wink, like, get what I'm saying, dude? The dragons are my only children and I cannot have any more kids, bright neon lights.
So do you think that's telling her that you need to find somebody else?
So
is that what you're saying? You're saying that you think that...
I think she's being upfront with him. I think she's being upfront. So is she clearly attracted?
Is she Jorah-ing him?
She might be. Well, she might be trying to hint that she wants to Jorah him by like being upfront with him. Like, hey, like right. If you're into me as much as I'm into you, like, no, like your line is ending because like I can't give you kids. And that would be, I mean, in universe, I think that would be a huge deal for somebody, especially like
what do you
for
mean
a woman
by,
to not
what do you
be
mean
able
by
to.
Joring, Michael.
Hmm.
What do you mean by Jorah-ing, Michael?
Well, the whole thing about with Jorah, how she told him that, you know, I appreciate the feelings you have for me and all that stuff, and but
friend zoning,
like, yeah, friend zoning, but at the same time, like, basically telling him like you need to go find your own stuff.
There's any correlation between how Dany feels about Jorah and how Dany feels about Jon.
Dany feels about
Jon like Dany feels about Dario
right.
and Khal Drogo.
Right, but what I mean, I just mean the end result of it. The end result of it of like, I'm sorry, but like I respect you enough to the fact that you need to like, I might not be the right thing because I can't have kids.
But I don't think she's saying like, no, we can't be together or whatever. I think she's just being upfront. Like, hey, dude, I can't have kids.
Right.
So
she wants to get with Jon Snow. She doesn't.
Can he even have kids? Like what's his sperm count after he was revived? Like, how do we even know that he's potent?
He's filled.
But
with
here's
fireballs.
A real question. Am I making it up in my head? I feel like there was some line or some talk or something that part of the reason that Jon took the black was because he didn't want to have children who
he didn't want to make more bastards.
Children of bastards, yeah.
Yeah.
That up or was that actually a thing?
He didn't want to make a bastard. So if he, you know, as a member of the Night's Watch, he's not going to get married. But now he's no longer a member of the Night's Watch, so it's not as big of a deal. He's the king of the North. So all
gotcha.
Right, he's unknown royalty. He's unknown royalty.
Okay, right. Yeah,
well,
right.
He is royalty now, but he is even more royal than he even knows he is.
Yeah.
But either way, getting sort of back to it, like, I think there are clearly complications if the whole, like, Jon loves Dany and they live happily ever after kind of thing. There are complications there. I don't think that John becomes a part of the line of secession discussion. I think that's in there so that Danny can feel paranoid about Tyrion and, well, so do you want to be the successor then, Tyrion? Like, who are you talking about will be the successor? I think that's sort of some political game.
And I also think Tyrion was talking about himself.
No, not at all. But I think Danny could have read it that way.
Oh, totally, yeah.
And then I also think that, like, the Tyrion mistrust stuff is not ending. They've spent this entire season building up this mistrust, and next episode we're getting the Lannisters all back in one room, and I think that's gonna, this is not over. Like, the Tyrion mistrust thing is certainly not over.
All right, well, let's cut there and let's go to the very last place to talk about in this episode, because there's some stuff I want to talk about, but I think it'll lead up to our final discussions. But to the last place. Still up.
Winterfell.
Sansa Stark.
Arya Stark.
Yes.
Littlefinger.
Brienne of Tarth.
Yeah, all of them. All of them.
All of them.
So we're getting a little brief here. The synopsis here is Arya confronts Sansa with the letter that she got last week from Littlefinger. Sansa and is a little defensive. She says, but I was a little girl. Arya, like, tests her about it, blah, blah, blah. At the same time, Sansa gets invited to go to King's Landing. She sends Brienne. Brienne's like, I don't really want to go, but no, you have to go because of your oath, blah, 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 blah. And at the very end, Sansa and Arya end up playing a game of faces. Arya threatens Sansa, but lets her live. What do you make of all this, Jake?
I think it's still, you know, we kind of got in this last couple of weeks, but I think that it's just a way to create some tension in Winterfell while all this other stuff is going along. I really don't believe that they're going to have Sansa kill Arya or Arya kill Sansa or have any like major kind of break between the two after all this has happened. But I do think they're going to push it right, you know, stretch it to the sideline, so to speak, as much as they possibly can to string it out until we finally get a resolution. And I think this may be where maybe somebody gets the best of Littlefinger for once. But that's what I'm hoping, because if not, then I think this could be bad news for my fantasy Game of Thrones prospects, because I don't know if I like Arya's. If Littlefinger doesn't go down, I don't think I like Arya's odds, if you get what I mean.
I really don't like any of this. Like, really, really don't like it. If this is all leading down a path where Littlefinger gets his, then maybe I'll look back on it and go like, oh, maybe I was being harsh. But I really don't like any of this. They've made Arya the villain, and I don't like it. I don't like seeing her on screen and hating her. Because, like, right now, it's just like, shut up, little brat. Stop. Like, stop. Like, A, she's talking and acting like Bran at this point, like all weird-eyed and all that kind of stuff. And B, she's just, like, she's being completely unreasonable. And maybe I'm being unreasonable because she has reasons. She's had many reasons to not trust people. They already had a history as siblings of not liking each other that much, and they never got the chance to go through that phase with your siblings where you hate each other for those like couple of years, and then you grow out of it and you get to better ages and you sort of come back to each other. And I think that they got separated in the midst of like their I hate you moment with their siblings, so maybe I'm being a little harsh, so they're sort of stuck in that preteen kind of like bullcrap. But either way, it's bullcrap. I really don't like this. The only other thing I want to say about it is I don't buy for one freaking second that Sansa's been invited to King's Landing. This is all Littlefinger bullcrap getting Brienne out of the picture after he plants the seed that Brienne can keep Sansa safe, and then sending Brienne away makes it a whole thing. Yeah, that's my, I'm not happy
here. Did I miss something? What is she being invited to King's Landing for?
Nothing. Nothing. Zero.
Presumably
that's
to take part in all of the, you know, festivities down there, but I don't see why she needs to be there, right? Because Jon Snow's already going to be there. So, yeah, I don't get it
but
either.
But how do they, like, okay, how do they know, how do them at King's Landing know that all this stuff is going to happen? Is that Jaime really influencing Cersei that much? I don't think so.
That's what I said. I don't think she's invited to King's Landing. I think that Baelish made this crap up.
And do we know, but you know, play devil's advocate here, do we know that the invite to King's Landing came from King's Landing, or did it come from Dany and Tyrion trying to get everybody together? But why would he?
It's
why
too
would
early.
Sansa
oh,
be
that's a good point. That's a really
but
good
it's
point.
Too but it's too early for that. Unless they're completely screwed. I mean, they
oh,
might
excuse
be
me.
Screwing with the Crows timeline.
Fly at supersonic
speed. I know, but like this stuff is happening before they even know that they're gonna have a meeting. Like, it just doesn't. The only thing that makes sense here is if Littlefinger has engineered something to create more strife between the sisters by having this summons to King's Landing look really bad and get, you know, potentially get Brienne out of the way or force Sansa into a decision or force some sort of confrontation, all of that kind of stuff. Like, if this doesn't lead directly to Baelish's comeuppance, then I'm just not happy at all because I don't like it.
Yeah, I didn't think of Baelish as engineering the invitation because I really did just figure that was part of Dany and Tyrion's kind of thing, although I never really thought about why Sansa, it was necessary for her to be there, but now it's kind of convenient that Brienne is going to have a reunion with Jaime at some point, and we got that in play again. But I do agree with you wholeheartedly, Alicia, that I'm hoping that this is a way for them to get Baelish something, you know, to resolve that somehow, because at some point we got to resolve these things. I'm hoping that's the case, because if it's not, then that means that either Arya or Sansa is turning heel, and I don't want to see that after all this time and what they've all gone through. I don't want to see either one of them as a baddie.
See, I don't think there's any chance that this is something that, like we had talked about Arya and Sansa sort of working together. I don't think there's any chance that they're working together here. The only thing I can hope for is that one of them sees reason at some point. Arya, I'm looking at you. And realizes who the real enemy is, and then that's how Littlefinger gets his comeuppance. But for now, they're clearly just being pitted against each other, and they're falling for it. Arya, I'm looking at you.
Okay, two final thoughts. One, I thought Arya looked better in this episode than she did last time. No, I don't mean like that. I don't. No, I'm.
Whatever, Michael.
I'm talking about competence because she looked really bad last week when Littlefinger was able to get the upper hand on her by forcing her into, because he knew she was spying on, he knew that she was spying on him, and he set her up into a trap. And now this week, I feel like she got the upper hand again by doing the same thing to Sansa. Secondly, wouldn't the season be awesome if it ended with Sansa killing Littlefinger?
Yes, please.
And then ripping off her mask and it's Arya?
Ooh.
Oh.
That's what I want.
Except that would mean that Arya killed Sansa.
I'm okay with it. Sansa sucks.
I will admit, during that scene, I had a moment of thinking, like, Arya's being so weird. Like, and then waiting for, like, the pull of the, like, the Arya mask, and it's Jock in her car or whatever. Or it's Littlefinger. I don't know. Either way.
Yeah, no.
It's the waif.
I was more upset, or I was more annoyed by Sansa in this episode than I was by Arya, Alicia. But, I mean, once again, that might be my bias because Arya's my fantasy player. But I don't think this is Arya and Sansa working together at all. I really do think it's Littlefinger trying to pull the strings. What my hope is that at the end of the day, the sisters figure it out and come to realization, and then they turn the tables on Littlefinger. But once again, this whole thing is so contrived because all they have to do is
have a conversation,
bro hug it out like Thoros and Gendry and the Hound did, and Beric did earlier in the episode. But they refused to do that, and that's very frustrating.
And that is something, like, I have been on Arya's case. Like, how infuriating is it? Like, Arya doesn't know. She's just Miss Paranoid, like, faceless men trainee person. Sansa should know better. If this stuff is happening, her first thought should be Littlefinger's doing something. Yeah, and what is her first thought? Go to Littlefinger, ask for his counsel. Like, come on. You know better than this.
You know, I'm sorry to extend this conversation, but it really did bother me because I thought that when they were writing that first scene, when Sansa and Arya are kind of, you know, Arya confronts Sansa, I thought that they started it out really well. Like, okay, they're really going to compare notes because Sansa says, you don't know what I went through. And then all she has to do is, hey, continue that conversation. But instead they get stubborn and they
All
and
she
they
had to say
down.
Was, well, what did you go through? Yeah. Let me tell you what I went through and blah, blah, blah.
Just compare notes, for Christ's sakes.
Right. I was waiting for Sansa to go, like, yeah, Joffrey, my beloved, the one who made me stand there and stare at dead father's head.
No, what we needed was,
and who
we needed Bran to roll in. She got raped. Arya ended up seeing everybody die.
Yeah.
Just yeah. like stone cold, just have him say that. Anyways, let's get to our final discussions. I think our final discussions are really going to be pivotal here. Number one, what can you see going down next week in King's Landing, Alicia?
I have no freaking clue. And I think that's a good thing because I don't know what to expect from this whole meeting of people. We're going to get a lot of people, a lot of like really important name characters standing in the same area having conversations, and it should be a lot of fun, but I don't know what the end game, like, I cannot imagine the season ending with Cersei going like, yeah, let's go kill the White Walkers. Like, somebody's going to get double-crossed. I don't know who it is, but something's going to happen. Like, my hope is that they end it on a really, like, cool note with, like, Tyrion's master plan of genius of catching Cersei in a trap, like, working. But that also seems like, well, then what are they going to do for the last season?
Right. Yeah, they have to get to some point that has some sort of resolution for this season, leads into next season, so that way, while still leading in the next season, so that way there's a reason to watch the final six episodes, or somewhere to go. I think it would be a little annoying if they all had some giant alliance, and they were all hunky-dory, and decided to just go in to fight the Night's King, because I think that's... How do you fight the Night's King in six episodes when we just learned that it might just take one episode to do it? So, I don't know. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Jake?
Just a couple things. Yeah, I think they're really trying to balance the two battles that we've been talking about, humans on humans and humans versus White Walkers. And there's a couple wild cards out there. Just real specifically, I don't think in the next time on they showed us any scene from that episode that happens more than like 4 minutes into the episode. Yeah, I think they're really saving a lot.
Totally agree.
Yeah, I think they're going to get right to the meeting, I'm thinking, and then like everything will go from there. I'm looking forward to, I already mentioned it, but I'm looking forward to seeing Brienne and Jaime back together and see how that affects the whole Cersei dynamic, because we didn't bring it up today because we didn't see any Cersei or Jaime, but I still totally think that Jaime's being played by Cersei and that she has no baby in her belly. So Brienne kind of upsets that mix a little bit, right? And Brienne does have some sort of sway on what Jaime thinks and could bring him back to... into some solid thinking. The other thing is, I'm just thinking about possible ways to end the season or possible ways to open the next season. There's a couple wild cards out there we haven't seen in a few episodes. Number one is Euron. What's he doing? How's he going to affect this? He wouldn't.
Yeah,
get
no
an,
kidding.
He would not get an invite to this parlay, I don't think, because he's not really a player. He's just kind of like one of Cersei's kind of lieutenants, so to speak, at this point. So he might figure in at some point. You'd think he would. Theon, I thought we saw a shot of Theon somewhere in the next time on. I'm not positive about that.
He was
so
in there.
That maybe that resolves separately from the parlay, or maybe it becomes a part of it. The other thing is that what's been bouncing around in my head about the battle with the White Walkers is there's still this thing called the Horn of Winter out there somewhere. And in the books and in the show, they have gone, they've really tried to sprinkle it in there every once in a while, and I'm trying to think about how the White Walkers, now we know, and I give me another sarcastic eye roll here, we know they're a day's walk from, at most, from the wall now. They're right on the wall. How do they get past the wall? It magically protects them from coming through, right? So presumably the White Walkers have some way to get through the wall, and I think we may have finally get a glimpse of the horn coming in. Does the wall come down? Does the wall stay up? Do they go over the wall to go battle them? Where does that final battle between the whites and the humans take place? We might not see it till the end of next season, but that's something that I'm wondering about.
Yeah, I think those are all great points. I really don't know what to make of next week, because is there going to be alliance? Is there going to be all is Cersei just going to say F you and fight them? Like, who knows? And I don't know how Euron gets involved into it. I really don't know. My biggest question, though, will we get to see Cleganebowl? Because we see them.
We
see
a good chance of that.
We see them walk. And the only, the mind you, last year made more sense for it when, if you would have had the High Sparrow and Cersei have a... trial by combat, and if there had been a trial by combat Cersei calls the Mountain and the High Sparrow calls the Hound because the Hound is a, you could argue, was a born-again faith guy, right? It would have made sense. I don't know what the how it happens, but the fact that they're meeting in like a Colosseum type thing, in an arena of some sort, makes me think that it's possible. And the reason I think it's possible, and I just wonder how you get there. Is it because does Cersei just does she threaten to start a war and then, you know, the Hound or, and the Mountain just start fighting? Or does the Hound see the Mountain and he go rogue himself? Like, what happens?
Yeah, I don't see any sort of one-on-one thing happening, like just like the way that the guys from Dorne, that whole battle, Oberon Stark, right. Or Oberon Stark.
Oberon Martell?
Yeah, Martell, I'm sorry. The way the Martell Mountain battle played out. But I could see some sort where it degenerates into a general melee. And then, yeah, I think definitely you got Hound Mountain action going there.
I don't know how they're going to get there. I don't know how logical they're going to get there. But I guarantee we're getting a Clegane Bowl. Why? Because everything about this season has been the showrunners basically doing fan service for everything. So them and not the having the Clegane Bowl doesn't make sense.
The other thing is, what's the point of the Hound going on that ship?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, he's in charge of carrying the white, but why does it have to be him? Right? Like, there's no... I think it makes more sense for him to stay at Eastwatch with Tormund. In a general sense, it makes more sense for him to stay at Eastwatch with Tormund than it does to go to King's Landing.
Yeah, I don't know. You could make the argument that since he is one of the people that's seeing the visions and he is Beric Dondarrion's kind of right-hand man at this point, especially now that Thoros is gone, he's kind of his second. And Beric has so much of this, you know, Lord of Light action
but
going.
But he's a traitor to the Lannisters
at this
point.
He's going to go there to testify. No, but he's also aligned very, you know, on Dany's side now. So I can see reasons why he would be there. I don't know if we're going to see Clegane Bowl this episode or if it's going to come, but I really agree with you guys in that it is inevitable. It will happen. Just don't know when.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see how it all comes together. Final question. Were you guys bummed that there wasn't any signs of an undead Hodor, either as a white or a white walker?
No. No, I was not bummed.
But he has to be at some point, right? He has to be.
Have we seen any shoutbacks to dead characters yet being White Walkers?
No.
Other than just the
only
one
Benjen
is
Cold Hands. That's it.
Yeah, well, and that doesn't even count because he's not an evil one. He was like a, you know, no. We just saw the, you know, at Hardhome when the people that the girl that John was talking to becomes a walker. But I'm curious to see if they're going to do that. But I don't want to see Hodor being a zombie. No, or Bran's dog either. You know, I don't want to see either of those things.
All right, if you haven't listened to us before, we do a fantasy game where we each have two characters. You get 10 points for winning a battle or a confrontation, 5 points for assisting in winning a battle or confrontation, and 5 points for killing a named character. Alicia's team has Jaime Lannister and Daenerys Targaryen. Mine has Cersei Lannister and Tyrion Lannister. And Jake has Arya Stark and Jon Targaryen. Anyways, let's talk about this. Alicia has 45 points going into this week. I have 25. Jake has 20. We didn't talk about this pre-show, but I think the only person getting points for this episode is Jake getting 10 for John leading the mission to get a white. Is that it?
Does Danny get some points for saving his ass?
I don't think so, because they lost
for saving
that
his
overall.
Mission.
They lost a dragon.
Yeah, they lost. I don't necessarily.
But John's,
the mission was a success. But I think
John's
that they
mission
lost
was
that
only
battle.
A, John's mission was only a success because Danny saved him. Like, that mission was going down the drain fast before Danny and the dragon showed up. I don't think she gets a victory because the dragon died. But I think Danny should get a damn assist. Like, they
I'm
were
okay
literally going to die. If she hadn't showed up.
All right, we'll give you an assist.
Thank you.
So now you have 50 points, and I have 25, and Jake has 20. We're also keeping tabs on players who aren't on here, because when you kill somebody, you also get half their points. And so we have to do that. And so we for instance, Euron has 30 points. If someone kills Euron, they're going to get 15 points on top of the 5 points that it takes to kill him. Grey Worm has 10 points for taking Casterly Rock. The Night's King, Does the Night's King only get 5 points for killing Viserion? Or does he also get 10 points for winning that battle? I don't know. Again, these are not our characters, but I feel like we have to tabulate this stuff up just in case when the Night's King inevitably dies.
I don't think he gets points for winning the battle. Because he didn't win the battle in that, even though, you know, it was more of a stalemate
at
best for him, right? I mean, you know, he got a dragon out of it, but, you know, he didn't kill the people that were there.
The mission succeeded, but the battle was a stalemate.
Here's a question. Well, but it has to be a direct kill though, right? Like, so the Night King doesn't get points for his army killing Thoros.
But he gets points for killing
Viserion. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Fine. So he's still at 5. But anyways, Lisa's at 45. I'm at 25. Jake, you're at 20. So we'll see how that continues to play out. Again, if you're looking for USC stuff, what?
Did Cersei get points for? Oh yeah, no, she did. Sorry, I was going to ask for killing the Sand Snake. Well,
yep.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Inevitably killing the Sand Snake for sure. Anyways, if you're looking for USC stuff, we'll be back tomorrow with an episode we've already recorded, so look for that. And then, Jake, what's coming up on What's Brewing Show this week?
Yeah, this week on Wednesday, we will have the B-Team on. That's when the episode will come out, and that's the other Brewing podcast that I'm sure that all of your listeners don't listen to, but we're going to have fun talking about that. Me and one of the hosts of that show, Michael Hanna, we like to argue quite a bit because he's very pessimistic. He's a very pessimistic Alicia, and I'm a very optimistic
pessimistic Alicia is out in full force.
Yeah, that's Hannah, and I'm the other one. I'm definitely the other one.
See, it's funny because I think you are reasonable. This is the scale I put up. Tell me if I'm wrong. I think you are the reasonable, objective one. Bill has the hot takes. Mike is the reasonable, optimistic one. And then Hannah is just the, oh my God, I've been beaten down. I'm incredibly negative, and SC is way better than us one.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael Hannah is Randy Quaid from Major League 2. And I know you'll understand that, Michael. Yeah, that's absolutely. And I appreciate you saying that I'm the reasonable one. I do feel like I'm reasonable and objective right up until it's time to predict records. And then I'm like, ah, yeah, they're going to go 13-0 and win the national title. But within the argument, I feel very rational and objective.
Right. Well, I think both you and Mike are very reasonable, just on the different opposite spectrums.
Right.
Bill just gets not that he's not reasonable, but he gets attached on to one thing, and then he's fully on that one thing.
Yeah, well, he has the attention of a gnat, so it's kind of hard to, you know, for him to really latch on to anything sometimes. But yeah, you know, that's what makes our dynamic so wonderful to listen to, though.
Yeah, you guys are awesome to listen to. I enjoy it. And if you want to listen to UCLA stuff, go listen to the What's Brewing Show. But if you've made it this far, I think you should be fine with people not sounding just like a mailbag episode every time, because we get countless emails, people mad that we don't sound like other podcasts or other certain podcasts.
But you get plenty of emails saying that they love your style too, though, so you feel good
about
yourself.
Not really. No, we don't get emails like that. We just get reviews.
Oh, yeah. Well, doggone it, people like you guys.
Not really.
you know, let's just ignore the 70 5-star reviews that we have and all that.
People just want to hear their name.
Pessimistic Michael is
podcast.
In full effect. Jeez.
Anyways, give us the final word.
Pessimism. Pessimistic Alicia is out in full force.
Can I blame Bob Connolly for this?
Yep. Can all we right, blame Bob Connolly for all of the leaps of logic in Game of Thrones? Because I'm here for it.
Yeah, we totally could.
For the night is dark and full of terror.
All right, guys. We will see you guys next week for the big finale. See ya.
See ya.
If you have any last words, now is the time.
Give him what he wants.
Away with you, dog.
Those are your last words. Fuck you. Come on, you can do better.
Silence!